There we go. So I'm going to talk about our efforts, Chicago Asthma Consortium's efforts over the last few years to increase stakeholder involvement and engagement in research and other asthma-related activities in Chicago. The Community Advisory Board that I'm going to talk about serves in an advisory capacity to the Chicago Plan project, which Molly just described. So just basically, our mission and our purpose, we really serve as a coalition to bring together a diverse group of individuals dedicated to improving asthma. Some of our activities and our goals are to raise awareness of asthma, improve asthma care by promoting evidence-based guidelines, link caregivers, patients, and the community together to asthma research, education, and other resources, increase asthma-friendly policies, and increase knowledge of effective ways to manage asthma. By way of background, we were formed about 20 years ago by the Respiratory Health Association and the American College of Chest Physicians to respond to the burden of asthma in Chicago and really the lack of coordination and collaboration on asthma-related activities. And at the time, there was really no forum for the asthma community to come together to do collaborative projects of any sort. So the development of the Community Advisory Board that I'm going to talk about is important because of this enhanced interest in community and academic partnerships. And we were responding to a lot of local requests over the last few years from researchers and investigators to provide a link to patients, caregivers, and the broader community. And so that led us, our local response was to form the Asthma Community Advisory Board in Chicago. And we received some seed funding from our trust. And in the past, we had a local Chicagoland Community Asthma Network to convene community meetings, but they really weren't engaged in asthma research. So we really wanted this board to provide a different function for us. And this is just a quick picture of our first meeting of the Community Advisory Board a couple years ago. And who we are. You know, while there are other research boards in Chicago, we really wanted to form ours to address the health disparities that we see at the community level. So we were really trying to take a community lens in the development of our Community Advisory Board. We have about 12 members and we're growing. We consistently have recruitment efforts to attract new members. And who are we? We're community health workers, adults with asthma, caregivers of children with asthma, patient advocacy partners, and community leaders that are really concerned about what they're seeing around asthma in their local communities. They all have experience with community-based research, and you know, we really try to focus on health disparities with that community lens. And our purpose, a pretty broad purpose, but I would say our primary purpose is to provide input on research. We provide links to the community, we inform the community about asthma research, and our board also provides a lot of great insight into the educational and advocacy needs of the community members and the patients and caregivers. To date, we've provided consultation for 5 local asthma research projects, and we serve as the external advisory board to 2 local research initiatives. So basically, what are the activities that our board has provided? Input on interview guides from the stakeholder perspective, input on surveys, input on some of the research design and instruments proposed to be used in the local research activities. Inputs on flyers, what are incentives that would attract caregivers to these research studies. We've provided some recruitment activities, assistance with trainings and role play. I think that, you know, that's one of the activities that I'm most excited about because our caregivers have actually provided training for some of the ED coordinators and community health workers on the Chicago Plan. And provided some input and role play discussions and provided some really great insight about how we can hopefully improve our recruitment efforts. And community meetings. In terms of educational and advocacy activities, the board has provided some input on some of the gaps they've seen. There's a lot of asthma information out there, but they have provided some great information about what's not out there that families are asking about that we can then respond to. Insight into challenges with policy implementation at the community level. We have great policies, but if they're not being implemented at the community level, they're not doing anyone any good. So they have provided a lot of that great insight. And then gaps. You know, what are policies and systems changes doing at the community level? And then I would also add, you know, when our board is also really interested in helping to disseminate research findings. So the evidence to action, you know, really getting the evidence to the community members that maybe don't have the access to the information. So as I mentioned, we serve in advisory capacity to the Chicago Plan. This was actually our first research consultation, and the Chicago Plan is funded by the PCORI and a member of the Evidence to Action Network. And some of the activities I've mentioned, our group really provided some great insight into helping us focus, organize our focus groups that Molly mentioned, and to provide us some insight on recruitment methods. How do we get people to the table? They provided some input on the interview guides that we used and actually helped, I think, tweak some language that, you know, folks would respond better to. Provided input on research plan and potential challenges. Have provided some insight into retention challenges and helping us to provide some solutions on that. And as I mentioned, the training of project staff. And this, I think training of project staff is an important component of what we've been able to do recently. And again, large consortium, these are all the institutions involved in the Chicago Plan. And now I just want to talk about, you know, we have this great board and we're really trying to formalize it and help put processes in place to sustain it into the future. And so, you know, one of the first things that we had started to tackle with our community advisory board is they wanted a consensus statement. They wanted a statement that said what was important to the community around asthma and also provide some guidelines about how to engage the community in asthma research. And that consensus statement is in its final stages. We've kind of taken a long process to make sure it's right and make sure that our advisory board is comfortable with it. You know, we kind of formalized a process by which researchers would seek the guidance of our community advisory board, and we developed an evaluation so that we have some evaluation information and, you know, information about how to make our consultations better and how to get to more folks. And then to sustain, we're really trying to promote the community advisory board heavily and also develop some pricing strategies so that we can continue to convene our board and provide the valuable consultation to the research projects. And then I just thank you. These are members of our community advisory board and they deserve to be recognized because they play a very important role in what we're doing. And then questions. Yes, we work very closely with the schools, and that is, you know, one of the main challenges that our community advisory board has highlighted, which we have known, is the challenge in getting policies implemented at the school level. So we do work very closely with Chicago Public Schools on a number of initiatives. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for questions, discussion, comments from all of you to any of our panelists here. Yes.
I work with, I have three sites in Columbus, the Bronx, and in Phoenix. You know, so many of these underserved families live in crisis mode and they're starting from day to day. So once the child gets discharged from the ED and, you know, life is good, they're not in crisis anymore. They have to turn their attention elsewhere. Can you elicit any of that kind of information that can help inform the future CHW?
Well, yes, definitely. So, and things come in layers, right? So, and that was one of the ways I think that also talking with the community health workers who've worked in asthma a lot helped us see a second layer of things. So, like, families would describe the problems with the medications. These shouldn't be problems. You shouldn't run out of medicine before the month is over. If you do, it's because you're medication sharing, or because you're losing it, or because you're not properly managed. And the families didn't always describe it that way. They described like the immediate problem, like, well, I run out of medicine. What choice do I have? And then through the different, because we did all these different levels of work trying to understand the problem, we started to see the full picture of what was actually happening. And where we really need to focus is not necessarily changing the policy so they can get more medicine. The real issue is making them understand how to properly use the medicine that they have, right? And how to manage the family system. You know, a lot of the adults don't have insurance, so they use the children's medicine. And you can say it's right or wrong, but when these inhalers cost $200 a pop and the children can get a large supply of them almost free through the Medicaid, that's how it goes, right? And families do the best they can. So we sort of got a big picture on those things. We also, they told us some things that we were concerned about trying to recruit in the emergency room, right? This is a point and time of crisis. And they acknowledged that and they're like, we love this study, this is such an interesting study, we would love to be part of this. And then I'd say, well, what if I asked you when you were in the emergency room? Oh no, I wouldn't sign up. And we're like, oh gosh, what are we supposed to, like, how could we make you see this is useful to you? And they gave us some strategies, and you know, in the end we weren't able to necessarily implement all of them because we did have we had already made a plan for and a commitment towards what we were going to basically do, which was through the emergency rooms. But it did prepare us at least to deal with what kind of consequences might come from that, which we're dealing with now, right? So none of it's a surprise that recruitment from the emergency room is hard. None of it's a surprise that people are almost Jekyll and Hyde in terms of their personality in the emergency room versus their personality a couple days later. And the parents told us that was going to happen. They're like, it's a whole different thing when you're there. So yeah, layer upon layer of different issues. The housing's a huge issue. And we knew that from the start, which is why we have formal partnerships with some of the tenants organizations within Chicago, and we got things organized so that we would have a mechanism for dealing with bad housing, which almost everyone has, but I mean, some of it's at crisis mode, literally. So we built that in even before we talked to the caregivers, and they just reaffirmed that issue. The psychosocial stuff was really big. We're doing some intakes in our questionnaire around some mental health issues, and when we showed them the questionnaires, some of the families were like, what? You know, like, you're going to ask us this stuff? And we're like, but we know this is a challenge for a lot of families. And so they kind of talked us through ways that maybe this would be better received. And also, again, prepared us for some of the ways that people were going to react to what we were showing them. And it's always better to be prepared for a reaction than to be, you know, hit out of the blue with it.
Are there questions for Molly?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, there and there.
Are you using
ACEs? ACEs?
Yeah, childhood.
No, we're using PROMIS. So we're using the NIH PROMIS measures.
So ACEs?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So the question was recruiting families into the interviews and the user-centered interviews and the focus groups. So we have a really weird, maybe it's not weird, and because we actually should have known better, because when we applied for the grant, we pulled data from all the clinical sites around asthma prevalence throughout the years so that we could understand our sample size and our distribution and make sure that we were ready. And at the time, you know, we did notice a dip over the summer in terms of that there's just not a lot of asthma exacerbations in the summertime. And unfortunately, we planned this formative period for over the next summer. I mean, that's the way the grant works. It started in March, and so we were ready to be doing this. And we had originally just hoped to, we have each clinical site has a site PI and a ED site PI. So in each of the clinical sites, we have one of the emergency department physicians who is funded as a co-investigator on the study. So they're very invested. And so we had signs up and things for people to, we wanted to capture them in the emergency room, right? Because that would be really fresh in their minds. And the volume was so low over the summer. We're talking like single digit ED admissions, despite the fact that we were in six different EDs, but that is how it goes in the summer here, is it really drops down. So we ended up recruiting through the clinics as well, because again, the site PIs were all in clinics, and the Chicago Asthma Consortium, Respiratory Health Association, all of that was sort of spamming the asthma community with, hey, focus groups, in-home interviews, we'll pay you, just tell us about your asthma experience. And through that, we were able to get together a large enough group. It would have been a completely different story if we had held that these, say, right now, because the EDs are full right now with asthma. But we hit a big lull around July, usually. So it was a little challenging. Yeah, so the question is, how do we collaborate with this big group, right? And Stacy and Kate could, who are also investigators on the study, could talk on this too. We have, you know, six clinical sites, and then, I mean, each one of these logos is a part, has a representation on the steering committee. And for a lot of the clinical sites have two representatives on the steering committee, like I said, the site PI and the ED site PI. So so our steering committee has, what, 30-some people on it? And so we have work groups within that, okay? So my work was conducted by the patient stakeholder work group, and actually Stacy is the chair. Stacy and Kate are co-chairs, I believe, of that work group. So some of the things, like, we pull off, right, into different groups. There's the community health worker work group, and they're the ones, the community health workers are coordinated through that work group. Even though they're hired by the six different sites, that group is coordinating it. The ED coordinators are coordinated through, I believe the lead of them is at UIC. So each site has its own ED coordinator, has its own community health worker, has its own co-investigators, but they're coordinated sometimes by a group that's outside of their institution. And what that allows is for a lot of cross collaboration. So right now we're doing recruitment, and so Lurie is a huge hospital here, right? Huge. And they've got a huge volume, and UIC is quite small, to be honest. So if there's several patients in Lurie that are eligible to be recruited, the ED coordinator from UIC might run over to Lurie and do some enrollments there. So by coordinating the whole unit instead of just site by site, we allow for this sort of cross collaboration across the institutions. And then in terms of decisions, the steering committee makes all large decisions for the group, and it's through majority rules vote. So there are the people who get to vote are the site PIs and the ED coordinator, ED PIs from each site, and then the PIs from each of the community organizations. So like I actually am sort of in a limbo position. I'm not an ED site PI. I'm part of the data coordinating center and the design team and everything, so I don't vote on things. But honestly, we've never had a decision where a vote mattered. I mean, everybody was always, we've always been in agreement on the path to move forward. And we've had difficult decisions to make, and we've talked through them, and the pathway has been relatively clear and most and basically unanimous in terms of how to move forward.
I'm going to ask a question. So this is for all of you, but I might turn it to Lisa and Molly on this. Molly, based on a specific one of your slides where you said that for the project you hired an ED coordinator to help kind of work within the ED for each of the sites, and that coordinator was paid for through the project. So it brings me to the question of sustainability and how something like this could really have an impact in terms of the fidelity and the ability to kind of carry out what you all are doing here in other settings. But as you know, and as many of you know, one of the challenges is around who pays for it. So if you try to disseminate and sustain something, there has to be a payment model. So the question is, you know, to you in terms of the project and how you're kind of addressing that. And then Lisa, to you, the question is directed more broadly towards, you know, how are you communicating things like this from all of the asthma studies in terms of end users having a role in helping with sustainability, such as payment?
So when we were together, and I can't say sat down to analyze because we didn't sit down to analyze. I didn't include the pictures, but we did the analysis at the Institute of Design, which is downtown here in Chicago, and we basically, like, you can sort of see in that picture a little bit that the walls are covered with boards and all the data were up, and we were walking around and talking and really trying to synthesize everything together is how we put it together. And it became obvious that to rely on the ED staff to deliver this would not work. And I'm very familiar with the literature on community health workers, and also there's a lot of literature just around the discharge process, and it is not a novel idea to think that you would put a staff person in an emergency room for the purpose of discharge facilitation, right? That's not an idea that we just came up with. I mean, there's a lot of data to support that. So we said, well, maybe what we need to then think about is the current model of relying on the provider to do the entire process is not feasible. And there is evidence, not just from us, but from others, that shows that we are going to need ancillary personnel in the emergency departments to facilitate with this discharge process. So that was what we changed our design to, is having a focused person on asthma discharge, which you could apply this potentially, if it's successful, we don't know. I mean, it's a trial, it's ongoing, right? But if it is successful, then you could say, well, maybe having focused discharge processes that go throughout the entire visit that have some sort of disease-specific lens might be beneficial for all systems, and the cost would be borne by the system because the hospital is penalized if you are readmitted within 30 days, right? And so there is a mechanism for how this could be financially sustained, and a model for how it could potentially work if we do find that it's successful.
So I think I mentioned that there's a group from the Asthma Network that are meeting to talk about how to make their intervention sustainable. And a couple of them, this is where sort of the co-learning comes in. A couple of them have already done this with other studies that they've worked on. And two in particular are sort of heading up this group. So I can just mention about their experience. So Stephen Teach, who's in the DC area, was able to show with one of his asthma interventions, pediatric asthma interventions,
that he could, that it reduced emergency room visits. And so he took this data to the state Medicaid office and said, I'm caring for the patients in your system, and we've been able to reduce emergency room visits using this intervention. You know, will you pay for this intervention? And they got, and they did. So that's one model, and he's talked with other investigators about, you know, kind of what are the data that he needed to show, who did he need to talk to, and so forth. And then another one of the co-investigators, Tara Bryant-Stevens, who's in Philadelphia, has actually been doing this for a long time, for many years. And so she also presented to the group, you know, here's what I've used, here's the techniques, here's some things you need to think about. In every state, community health workers are, you know, licensed, accredited differently, and paid for differently. So work with your Medicaid office to figure out what those parameters are. And then also think about value-based reimbursement. So where you can be paid on a, you know, some value-based metric, that enables you to take those funds and structure your team, your staff, your intervention to take advantage of that. So those are just two of the ways that that the PIs are thinking about sustainability, and I hope over the course of the project we'll get more and more ideas like that.
Other questions? Comments? Yes.
I'm a geopath. I work in the Pauvian NIH kind of stuff. I'm kind of interested in knowing if there's a better way for our researchers to, I guess, look more on the developing the evidence more so than implementing the action. There's a better way for our investigators to do clinical trials and work to coordinate that.
I might take that. Did you say you were from NIH?
Yeah.
So for those of you who came in late, I'm with PCORI, and I direct the Addressing Disparities Program, which is one of PCORI's five national priorities for research. So each of our programs at PCORI has a specific focus. Clearly, the Addressing Disparities Program has a focus on projects that target and reduce disparities across a number of conditions and outcomes. To your question, we collaborate quite extensively with NIH, and actually one of PCORI's, PCORI has three overarching goals, and one of those three overarching goals is to influence how others conduct research, such as NIH or ARC or private foundations and so forth. So through our collaborations with NIH, we're beginning to see some change. And you know, one specific example that I can give is that within the disparities program, we just funded $25 million in research to reduce disparities in hypertension. And we worked with NHLBI and NINDS and developed a memorandum of understanding with NIH that NIH would, for PCORI, with our criteria and the way that we do our merit reviews, that NIH would implement that. So the way that PCORI conducts merit reviews for each of the projects that come to us, we have two scientific reviewers, we have one patient reviewer, and then we have one stakeholder. This could be a clinician or a health system leader, or somebody from a health plan, et cetera. We also have two criteria that are unique to PCORI, and they are patient-centeredness and patient engagement. So when NIH conducted the reviews, they actually incorporated PCORI's review metric. And part of that, the reason I'm giving that as an example, because it is a way to operationalize this notion of engagement throughout the kind of life course of a study. That includes highlighting high priority topics to how we conduct merit reviews. More generally, we do have a whole engagement team at PCORI, and we are at this point really thinking strategically about how to help investigators basically meet up, kind of do matching with stakeholders in the community. That would be within local areas as well as, you know, Lisa pointed out, with national stakeholders, because we recognize there has to be a nice balance of both national representation, so the national groups that can really push something out and have the resources to do so, but also to really facilitate the change that happens at the community level. You know, as you heard here. So we're really working within our engagement team to facilitate that process within PCORI. Yeah, so your question, though, is focused around kind of, is it around the engagement piece, or is it around the generation of the evidence, because you distinguished it? Yeah, I think that's part of the goal of this Evidence to Action Network, is that, you know, in order to really use research, we need to start thinking about not just kind of the long-term measures and waiting for the end of a project before we say, okay, here are the results, here's the publication in JAMA or in NEJM, and we kind of stop there. I mean, that's been the traditional model of research. I've been, you know, I was a researcher for 20 years before I went to PCORI as a funder. So part of the kind of accelerating this process, you know, to your question, is making sure that engagement happens early. So engagement in terms of prioritizing the topic and helping to define the question and some of the outcomes, doing that early with stakeholders, not just in a siloed research team, because I know, you know, as a researcher, I can talk to other researchers and come up with a great design and great method. But my study might not be the primary question that the end users are looking for in terms of answers. So we want to make sure that process happens early. And then working continuously throughout the life course of the project to really start to discern what the lessons are early on versus waiting to the end. And I mean, that really was the goal of you know, saying that we want to focus on dissemination and we want to put resources behind it. So we'll do this through this model that we call the Evidence to Action Network to get that dialogue started early rather than later. Other questions? Okay, well, join me in giving our panelists a round of applause. Thank you.